From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And we're going to start this hour with Hurricane Florence, which is shaping up to be one of the worst storms the Carolinas have ever seen. It's currently clocking in as a Category 3, but the National Hurricane Center is predicting Florence will become a strong Category 4 storm before making landfall along the southeast or mid-Atlantic coast Thursday. The last Category 4 hurricane to strike the mid-Atlantic region was Hugo in 1989. That means a lot of people in Georgia, the Carolinas, Virginia may not have seen a storm this severe before. Jeff Huffman is a meteorologist at the University of Florida Weather Center. Jeff, you have our attention now, Category 4. Where is Florence and how is she looking?
Well, the storm, Robin, is rapidly intensifying. It went from a Category 1 storm Sunday evening to now a Category 3, and as you mentioned, expected to continue intensifying this afternoon. All indications are that it will be at least a Category 4, maybe briefly a 5, but it could also briefly weaken before coming ashore in the Carolinas. The big point here is that, and the Hurricane Center said this in their 11 o'clock advisory, it is expected to be a large and very dangerous major hurricane at landfall on Thursday.
Boy, so what are we talking about? We've said the Carolinas, but give us the broader sense of who might be affected.
Well, yeah, you have to remember that as a storm strengthens, the impacts are going to spread well away from where the center comes ashore. Right now, everybody's focusing on the cone. As we get closer to tomorrow, Wednesday, and Thursday, remember that cone will get smaller at the coast because that means confidence is getting higher on where it might go. So the impacts, though, could spread well outside that cone. And in fact, they will. The storm surge unit from the Hurricane Center will probably issue a storm surge watch as early as tomorrow morning. They just tweeted that. Hurricane watches will probably go up for a large section of the coastline, probably stretching from near Myrtle Beach all the way through all of North Carolina into southeastern sections of Virginia.
And what should people do?
Well, if you live in an evacuation zone or near one, the most important thing you can do is listen to your local authorities and let them guide you through this. They have been through all the rehearsals for something like this. They know there's a plan in place. They know how to get you out and get you to a safe location. If you're not in one of those zones, consider taking in some evacuees. Or, and especially if you're inland and near a flood-prone area, absolutely start preparing for the possibility of hazardous inland flooding. This system is expected – Florence is expected to slow to a crawl over the Piedmont areas. It could produce heavy rain for days in portions of North and South Carolina and Virginia.
So when you approach a puddle, don't drive through it. It's not a puddle. You know, it could sweep you away. But South Carolina, North Carolina, Virginia have already declared states of emergency. Remind us what that means.
It means motions are being put in place to help citizens protect their life and their property at all levels of government, and that should be a signal to everyone in those states to also stay aware and continue finishing preparations. I think, Robin, we have until about Wednesday afternoon to finish all the preparations along the coast. You might have until Thursday morning further inland, but this storm system, once again, Florence, expected to be a major hurricane at landfall.
Yeah, and remind us, you've said four, probably five as well. What does that mean again? What is the difference?
Well, the Category 4 versus Category 5, both of those are deemed catastrophic as an adjective by the Hurricane Center. So we, whether it briefly becomes a 5 or not, preparations should be made for a Category 5. Because remember, the Hurricane Center wants us all to prepare for at least one category greater than the official forecast because of the natural, tendencies there could be in terms of fluctuation and intensity right up until landfall. So I encourage everyone in those areas to prepare for an extreme event.
That's Jeff Huff, a meteorologist at the University of Florida Weather Center. And I know, Jeff, there are people who always say, oh, you're blowing this out of proportion or frightening people. That's not the point, right? The point is to help people get ready.
Yeah, Robin, remember, a lot of the science goes into calculating the risk for specific locations, and it's usually the worst-case scenario. If there's a reasonable chance the worst case can happen, that's what we encourage people to prepare for because we know the outcome, if they don't, could be significant or extreme. So this is a serious situation for anyone listening along the coast from Charleston, South Carolina, all the way to Baltimore and Washington, D.C. metro areas.
Jeff, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, accusations of anti-Semitism have found their way into the already heated New York governor's race between incumbent Andrew Cuomo and actor and first-time candidate Cynthia Nixon. Yesterday, Cuomo denied having anything to do with a state Democratic Party mailer that suggested Nixon has been silent on the rise of anti-Semitism. The head of the state party apologized, but the mailer was sent out right before the Jewish New Year and Thursday's primary. Grace Rao is Spectrum News New York One political reporter and host of the Off Topic on Politics podcast. Grace, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
This mailer, the latest in a pretty tough campaign. What more can you tell us about it?
Well, this mailer went out, a source tells us, to 7,000 households, and it's an attack ad, and frankly, a shocking one, especially given the fact that Cynthia Nixon, while not Jewish herself, is raising two of her children. They're Jewish. She belongs to a synagogue, and this is one of these things that seems designed to come in the final stretch of the campaign and smear a candidate. What's interesting here, though, is that Governor Cuomo, while he effectively controls the state Democratic Party in New York, he's saying, look, I had nothing to do with this ad. I had nothing to do with this mailer. But anyone who is close to this race and is following it finds it hard to fully believe his denials. Huh. And while it is entirely possible that he did not personally sign off on this, it's hard to imagine the party okaying and green lighting a mailer like this without some kind of tacit approval from the governor or his team.
The other question is, why bother with tactics like that? Because if you believe the polls, and there's a brand new one out today that says Cuomo is up 40 points over Nixon, so why get down in the gutter like that?
Well, that is the question. And to me, my interpretation of this mailer is that the polls are not to be believed either, necessarily. We've seen that a lot this year with polling that has not captured the mood of a very restive electorate, especially among the Democratic Party and the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. So attacks like this one, which frankly have come back to bite him, suggest that the governor, his campaign team, the state Democratic Party, that they're frankly very, very worried that Cynthia Nixon could indeed beat him in this primary and defy all the odds.
He has made a few other gaffes, for lack of a better word. He has made this comment last month that America was never that great, of course, kind of riffing off of the Donald Trump saying there. There was an issue with the old Tappan Zee Bridge just recently that got him into some hot water. I mean, is the governor making mistakes that could hurt him in a race that he otherwise could have easily won?
I think he is. I mean, throughout this campaign, myself, my colleagues, we've argued and said repeatedly that Cuomo is his own worst enemy, that he's almost fighting a primary battle, not so much against Cynthia Nixon, but in his own head against a perceived enemy. And as soon as he feels fearful, he starts to make unforced errors. I mean, the bridge incident that you refer to, I would argue, is much bigger than a gaffe. Frankly, on Friday, just a few days ago, he held with great pageantry a news conference that Hillary Clinton attended to open up the bridge that is going to replace the old Tappan Zee Bridge. It's named after his father, former New York Governor Mario Cuomo. He's driving across the bridge, and it was set to open to cars that evening or early Saturday morning. And then, after all of that fanfare, engineers essentially said it's not safe to open the bridge because the old Tappan Zee Bridge could potentially, or piece of it could fall into the new span, which has now raised a series of questions about whether the governor rushed the completion of the bridge so that he could have a big celebratory news conference less than a week before the primary. So there are some serious questions, I think, and problems of the governor's own making that now he's having to answer for in the final stretch of a campaign that, frankly, should be theoretically a cakewalk for someone in his position.
Now, they did have a debate late last month. These two candidates sat down. They talked about issues such as driver's licenses for undocumented immigrants, healthcare access, New York City's struggling infrastructure, which you just referenced there with the bridge. Let's listen to some of that exchange.
My opponent lives in the world of fiction. I live in the world of fact. Let's just do a few facts, okay? The subway system is owned by New York City.
The subway MTA system has been controlled by the state since 1965.
Can you stop interrupting? Can you stop interrupting?
Can you stop lying?
So got kind of feisty there. But where do these two politicians come down? I mean, is Cynthia Nixon that much more progressive than the governor?
She is. She certainly is. And since she got into this race, there's been something that we in New York have referred to as the Cynthia effect, which is that just her presence, her primary challenge against Governor Cuomo, has forced him further to the left. One of the examples is around legalizing marijuana. It's something that Cynthia Nixon has been in favor of. Governor Cuomo had been very opposed, but in the last few months, his position on that has evolved, and now it seems as though New York State could be poised to legalize marijuana use. That's just one example of him shifting as a result, I would argue, of Cynthia Nixon getting into this race.
Grace Rao, Spectrum News New York One political reporter, host of New York One's Off Topic on Politics podcast. Thanks for watching this race for us. We appreciate it.
Thanks for having me.
This week, folk singing legend Joan Baez begins the North American leg of her Fare Thee Well tour, scheduled to run through May 2019, a tour she says is her last, ending a nearly 60-year career, which began with recordings like this one, Girl of Constant Sorrow, from Joan Baez's 1960 self-titled debut album.
I am a girl of constant sorrow, have seen
Joan Baez's latest album is Whistle Down the Wind. When I first sat down to listen, I thought, well, this will be nice. Minutes later, why are my cheeks wet? Why can't I move? Here's a little of the title track.
I can't stay here, and I'm scared to leave. So kiss me once, and then I'll go to hell. Whistling down the wind.
So is this it from Joan Baez? Let's ask. Joan Baez, welcome back.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
Is it really your last?
You know, I've left it open as far as albums go. My guess is this is the last one. And it also is part of the last touring. You know, 30 years ago, I asked my vocal coach when I would know it was time to quit, and he said, your voice will tell you.
Yeah, but, you know, your voice sounds richer, deeper, wiser. does it hurt? Do you feel it's harder to control?
Yes, it's harder to control. It doesn't hurt, but a whole lot of the time, the sounds I want to hear are not coming out. The fact is the vocal cords are a muscle. And they're tired. And eventually gravity takes over everything, but it's starting with my vocal cords.
Well, and why did you pick the songs that you did? Because they all do sound like they have a whiff of goodbye, perhaps. I mean, I'm thinking of Josh Ritter's Be of Good Heart.
I never had a crystal ball. I never had a crystal stone. I never claimed to know it all. All I know is what I've known.
The only frame that we had when we started was to see if we could create something that amounted to a bookend to the first album, which was nearly 60 years ago. And then it kind of falls in place, and all I can tell you is that it makes its own design. I mean, for instance, if it hadn't had Another World and the president sang Amazing Grace, it would have been a beautiful album of very pretty songs, but it wouldn't have the depth that it has. So some songs, like the president's song, drop out of the sky and are just my good fortune to hear.
This is Zoe Mulford's song that she wrote after then-President Obama delivered a eulogy for the Reverend Clemente Pinckney, who was one of those gunned down at the Charleston, South Carolina, terrible, terrible shooting. And he arrived and just sang, recognizing that words just wouldn't do it. Let's listen to a little of the song.
The president came to speak some words, and the cameras rolled, and the nation heard. But no words could say what must be said for all the living and the dead. So on that day and in that place, the president sang Amazing Grace. The president sang Amazing Grace.
Joan Baez, is that one you wish you'd written?
Oh, yes. Back when I met Zoe, that's the first thing I said. Boy, I wish I'd written that one.
But others have said, and I'm thinking of Pitchfork, that in that way, the collection you've put together recalls for them Richard Farina's Birmingham Sunday, your sister's husband's song that he wrote after the 1963 bombing of the 16th Street Baptist Church. And you had that on your 1964 album.
The church, it was crowded and no one could see. That Cynthia Wellesley's dark number was three. Her prayers and her feelings would shame you and me. And the choir kept singing of freedom.
Yeah, it's a little bit bookendish. It's also sad that we still have to write this stuff. And just as far as the voice goes, the Birmingham Sunday was done in a voice which I no longer have. I mean, I may not any longer need it, but I miss it.
What do you mean by that? The range or the...
The range.
Yeah.
And, I can, if I'm very clever, about reinventing songs, I find the range, and then I find where I can kind of pop up out of that range for a little bit, but I can't sustain a note up there, which is kind of distressing because that knocks certain songs right out of their repertoire.
Two things. First of all, a wonderful misspeak. I find the rage.
Yeah.
Rage and range. But I'm hearing your struggle as an artist, but as a listener, again, just the depth that I'm hearing is a beautiful thing to hear. Let's listen to another piece. It knocked me over. Apparently, it did you as well when you first heard Mary Chapin Carpenter sing this when you were on stage together in 2017. The Things We're Made Of.
I felt the air on my face and the night pressed inside my palm. A moment captured in a place. This memory stays strong. Oh, my darling, oh, my love. Oh, my darling, oh, my love. Oh, my darling, oh, my love. The things that we are made of.
Joan Baez, what is this song written by Mary Chapin Carpenter about for you?
Actually, just beauty. I mean, I heard her singing it, and I immediately started to cry. And then I went over when she was through and put my arms around her and said, I want that song. And she said, take it. She'd already recorded it, but...
What else would you say to Joan Baez? No,
it's mine.
Well, it is, and it is just beautiful. How are you... I mean, we've talked about your voice. How are you feeling about the life that you are stepping away from and what you created?
First of all, I'm sort of experiencing premature nostalgia. Mm. It was the first or second night in Paris during the shows there, and I suddenly just had a meltdown. I thought, well, what's this about? Well, it was about having the first real feelings about the end of touring, because I've been doing it forever, and I've loved it. And I love it now.
But also, you feel pretty good about yourself. You were at some important moments in history. You were not sentimental about things. You were clear-eyed. Whether it was anti-war, anti-poverty.
Well, first thing that comes to my mind is that I was just wired for it. The background of my family, I'm sure, has something to do with it. That they became Quakers and they became serious about not hurting people. I got passionate about that. And then, as it turned out, I could sing, and there I was, 13 years old with my ukulele, singing about Emmett Till.
The young black man who was murdered.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. The young kid who was murdered. And, I could have done opera, but I wanted something, it appealed to me that folk music was connected with people and with the earth. And then when I heard Pete Seeger sing and heard about him and the things that he did, it felt like home.
Yeah. Of course, a huge part of your career, singing out passionately against war. When we spoke a few years ago, and I told you, relayed a story about how, you know, we had done protesting in the late 60s, and it had driven a wedge between my father and I. He was a Marine who served at Guadalcanal at 16 and couldn't understand this. And years later, I had forgotten about that rift. It was during the Watergate investigation, and it had just been revealed that Nixon had waged a secret war in Cambodia. And I get this call from him on the phone, and he just said, "I will never forgive that man for coming between me and my daughter."
Oh, dear.
Well, I looked up, and you were crying.
Yeah. As I am again now. Those things are so meaningful, and we probably talked about it back then, but somebody comes up in San Francisco and says, "You, Joan Baez, yes. Boy, did I hate you in the 60s, and boy, was I wrong." No, that means everything to me.
That's Joan Baez. For more on her Fare Thee Well tour, go to hereandnow.org. Joan Baez, so I'm just saying, maybe like a revival concert at some point.
My goal is not to die on stage in a wheelchair when I'm 90.
Although, what a way to go.
Yeah, that's true. That would be quite a way to go.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure. Thanks, Robin.
I need another place. Will there be peace?
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Another word.
More than 3 million Americans struggle with stuttering. There's no cure, but some treatments can help. Researchers at the University of Texas, San Antonio, are using machine learning to retrain people's brains before they speak. Paul Flav from Texas Public Media reports.
Alessandro Salazar sits in a soundproof booth and recites nonsense phrases from a computer monitor. They're supposed to make him stutter.
Cassie Wadi. Lily Rashius.
The university student wears a skullcap of sensors, says the phrases, and sometimes stutters, while a computer reads his brainwaves. Salazar has stuttered since he was a kid. He did traditional speech modification therapies and tried slowing down his speech.
Yeah, people try to like to talk slower.
But he says speaking day-to-day isn't like talking in a speech therapist's office.
In real life, that's not like something you can do. You'll get excited, you'll get nervous, you'll get anxious, you can get all these different emotions, and like you can't be this calm robot voice all the time.
Outside the booth, speech pathologist Farzan Irani stands in front of a bank of computer monitors, all with Salazar on them. He listens for stuttering, or what they call disfluency.
Piscasi sinquate.
Again, that was fluent with a little bit of hesitation on the second word.
Irani says he's involved with this research because traditional therapy can wear off for some people.
They'll get fluent in the therapy room, they'll get fluent while they're in therapy, and then a few months down the road, the stuttering tends to rise again.
University of Texas San Antonio researchers think they can change that if they can get an accurate snapshot of the brain's waves before a person stutters, says assistant professor of research Jeffrey Mock.
We are hypothesizing it's a speech preparation problem, not a speech production problem.
Mock walks into the sound booth and inserts a large syringe into the cap on Salazar's head. Some sensors aren't reading well, so he pushes the syringe back and forth, swinging it around like a joystick as he injects more saline gel. Mock says he's interested in the research since he stutters, but also because their goal is to read the brain and determine what happens next.
As a neuroscientist, it's really being able to predict behavior before it occurs. I mean, that I think has a wide range into many different fields.
brainwave data will be analyzed with the help of computers using machine learning, algorithms that can better detect subtle changes in the brain, as well as help create a better predictive model. Their current model predicts stuttering about 80% of the time, says UTSA psychology professor Ed Golub.
Then the next step, which we haven't done yet, is to use the fluent brain pattern as a target, to essentially train the person's brain to make that pattern more often.
Golub wants to create a therapy that gives a person visual or audio cues, letting them know if they're getting closer to the target brainwave pattern. Golub says if this biofeedback works for stuttering, it may work on more serious conditions.
Ones that are even worse. People that suffer strokes, for example. People that have Alzheimer's disease. People that have traumatic brain injury.
Alessandro Salazar doesn't see the research benefiting him because he's learned how to cope with his stuttering. But that wasn't always the case.
Because I remember when I was like little, I had all this stuff to say. Like I knew exactly what I wanted to say, and then I would try to talk and it wouldn't come out.
He hopes his participation helps a kid like that. For Here and Now, I'm Paul Flabb in San Antonio.
And let us now consider Gen Zers. Yep, that's your name, young people 14 to 22. If you are a Gen Zer or live with one, you know, for instance, that Zam is their damn.
Z is for Zam, which can usually be followed by Zaddy, also Z.
A is for Ayo, which is something I would say when something good happens. Like, I finally got a job. Ayo!
W is for What Are Those? It's a video from Vine where this kid walked around pointing at people's shoes that he thought sucked and said, What are those?
Unsult is a backhanded compliment, as in, you're very organized for a millennial.
Oh, snap, you just unsulted her. Those are some examples from the website A2GenZ.com, one of many popping up to interpret the language of Gen Zers, the demographic after the millennials. Phrases like on fleek, when someone is perfectly groomed or styled. Preach, when someone strongly agrees with someone else. But wait, those could already be out of favor. How would you know? Especially if you're a marketer looking to reach Gen Zers. Well, now there are consulting firms to help brands and companies do just that. And one is made up entirely of the demographic the companies are trying to reach. It's called Juve Consulting. Nick Jane is the co-founder and COO and a sophomore at Princeton University. Nick, how did you come up with this idea? What need are you filling?
At the end of the day, what it comes down to is that we live in a world where a lot of people are making decisions about Gen Z that affect Gen Z, but they're not talking to teenagers. I found myself a couple years ago at a couple White House roundtables and a few other rooms.
Wait. You found yourself at some White House roundtables. Tell me how that sentence came to be.
So I did an internship with the Muslim Public Affairs Council the summer after my junior year in high school because in my school I noticed like this increasing sense of Islamophobia and I really wanted to do something to combat that. There's a day that they invited me to come to a White House roundtable with the focus being tackling discrimination in schools. But then when I was sitting in the room and we're talking about, you know, how to reduce discrimination in schools, I realized that I was the only person under the age of 30 in that room. And how is that a feasible way to go about tackling discrimination in schools and to create policy that will impact millions of youth throughout the country if there are no youth even present to have their voice be heard in the conversation? It was places like those and situations like those that really made me realize that there is a need to empower Gen Z voices across the country, regardless of their experience and background, and for them to have a voice in the decisions that are being made that will genuinely affect them for years to come.
We saw that after the Parkland shooting. I mean,
yeah, you know. Exactly.
But also, this is companies and brands. And boy, if anyone Googles, they will find every single huge advertising firm has a website specifically on how to talk to Gen Zers. And it's hilarious. You know that scene in the movie Airplane where the stewardess says she speaks jive, so she interprets for someone else? You probably don't remember that. But this is how it feels. It feels, you know, anthropological, like they're trying to speak of this subspecies of teenager that they don't understand at all. Is that where you come in?
That's exactly right. You know, the ideology that we tell our clients on a day-to-day basis is that it's not enough to pay a lot of money for research about Generation Z. What you really need to do to understand us is to engage us, is to include us in the conversation, and then you'll get a better understanding of who we are, and you'll actually be able to create products and advertisements and campaigns that really appeal to us and really relate to us.
Now, well, but how much are you a part then, inadvertently, of your generation being co-opted. You read deep into some of these papers. This particular article was talking about how in the past there was almost a trickery used to get, let's say, millennials. You'd put things on social media platforms and you'd say, hey, tell us your personal story about this. And you'd get somebody to click through and then come to a sales pitch. What this paper from the director of editorial strategy at Hill Holliday is saying, hey, the good news is you don't have to do that with Gen Z. They go directly to brands. They follow brands on Twitter and Instagram. Forget the golden age of television, which was used to sell to little boomer kids. There's never been a better captive audience than Gen Z because they are so locked into brands and into social media. Are you worried that you're participating in that view of Generation Z as just this thoughtless consumer base?
There are a lot of misconceptions about Generation Z, and one of those misconceptions is that we just buy everything we see on social media, that we follow these brands and we say, oh, they have a new product. Oh, I'm going to buy it. And the truth is that if I see a brand posting advertisements, in the vast majority of cases, I will be able to recognize that that advertisement was posted by somebody that does not really know how to engage with social media in the same way that we do, that maybe is not as literate, per se, in social media. And as a result of that, like, we're actually much more skeptical of a lot of the things that are posted on social media. We're not just a Generation Z that clicks through and buys all these things that are posted on social media. But again, we're looking for a lot more.
Give me an example of something that's like just not authentic.
There was a commercial that I remember was posted on Generation Z, and it was meant to be clever. So I'm spacing on the brand right now, but essentially what they did is they put a black line on the screen that was a little hair. A lot of people would click on it to try to like wipe it off the screen. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a really clever marketing technique because when you tried to wipe it off the screen, it would take you to their website to buy their shoes. And they were like, okay, we're going to get a lot of Gen Zers with this because they're going to go to our website. And then, you know, because they're already there, they're going to want to buy our shoes. But the truth is, when you click on that and it takes you to their website, most of us were just annoyed that we went to a website that we didn't want to go to and that we were tricked into clicking on this link. You know, it wasn't an authentic way of engaging with us. On the other hand, I'll give you a counterexample, which was about a year and a half ago, Gushers started releasing this line of advertising on Instagram where they were posting their advertisements in the form of memes. And so there's a very popular meme about 2 years ago that was, it's called Me Versus the Guy You Told Me Not to Worry About. And Gushers posted a picture of their product, a very good picture, and a very bad picture of a competitor. And they basically said, me versus the guy she told you not to worry about. And very immediately took off. But more importantly, as I was scrolling through my Instagram feed and I came upon that ad, you know, I stopped and looked at it. I thought it was funny. I laughed. And then when I went to see which account posted it, which of my friends posted it, I realized that it was a company that posted it. That's the type of advertising that doesn't stand out in our feeds. It doesn't, you know, make us turned off because we know it's an ad and we know that these platforms are just using those advertisements to make money. That's the type of advertisement that really engages with us and is really effective when it comes to Generation Z.
Okay, a couple things. First of all, you mentioned memes, and I'm looking at something else that somebody posted from a big advertising agency. It's sort of like an instruction manual for companies trying to reach your age group. And it says, so how can we learn to speak their language effectively? This series will be focused on the unique forms of language used to communicate. First up, memes. What are memes? So they go on, and you've just said that you like it when one of these memes shows up in your feed and you don't know it's from a company till you look. That would drive me crazy. You don't feel invaded? Somebody trying to use you?
I think when you get to the point where there's so many people that are trying to use us, as you say, or trying to market to us and are just doing such a terrible job doing so, that it's refreshing to see a company that's really trying to engage with us. You know, quite honestly, is most likely employing Gen Zers to make those memes for them.
Okay, just a quick lightning round of which words are still valid in your age group. T for gossip.
I think it's definitely valid. It's much less common than it was like a few months ago. But yeah, I would say it's so good.
Lit for something that's amazing. It's lit.
Lit has now become very ironic. So it's like You use lit in a joking way. But if an adult or a company were to use lit, we'd automatically cringe at that.
Okay. No wonder I got a cringe the other day. Draking for something that's emotional after, of course, the Canadian singer Drake.
I do not think that's a thing.
Okay. Ship, when someone thinks two other people should have one, a relationship?
It was really popular about 2 years ago, and it's much less popular now, but I don't think it would be, like, bad to say it.
I am so out of it, aren't I? Tell me, what's hot now?
Well, a big one that's coming up on Twitter is Stan, STAN. It's short for stalker fan.
Oh.
But now it really just means Like it's a form of applause. So it's like, we stan Oprah, right? Means like, we love Oprah. Oprah's amazing. Oprah's fantastic, you know, Queen Oprah. Another good one is RIP, R-I-P. So obviously that has a common meaning of rest in peace, but people now use it kind of in very different ways. So I might take a test, and if I don't think it went well, I might walk out and say, RIP me. And that's a very common thing to say as well.
And just checking, sir, is that still what's up?
Maybe among some people, but not like that widespread.
Thank you. You've just sort of insulted me.
You know, what's important is that you're trying.
Thank you. That's Nick Jain, one of the co-founders and CEO of Juve Consulting, staffed entirely by young people ages 14 to 22, the Gen Z demographic. Nick, thanks so much.
Thank you for having me, Robin.
Jury selection is underway today in the trial of Chicago police officer Jason Van Dyke, who's facing first-degree murder charges for killing 17-year-old Laquan McDonald in 2014. It's a case that sparked citywide protests and calls for police reform. Van Dyke is white. He shot McDonald 16 times as the teenager, who was black, walked away from police. Patrick Smith is a criminal justice reporter for WBEZ, and he's at the courthouse in Chicago. Patrick, hi. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Fine, thank you. Look, we can hear you're at a busy courthouse right now. This has got to be a very big day for people in Chicago. How closely are they watching this trial?
Well, people are going to be following this trial really closely. You know, there's actually organizers who have gotten a permit to protest outside of the courthouse each day that the trial is going on. However, one hiccup in that is that jury selection is underway today, and we're not sure how long that's going to take. The defense is asking for it to take up to 6 weeks. They're interviewing each individual member of a 200-person potential juror pool.
6 weeks just for the jury?
That's on the high end. I don't expect it to take that long, but that's how long the defense is asking. And so we're in this situation where people have really been waiting for this trial. But now it's sort of like it's starting, but it's not exactly starting because opening statements won't be for a little while.
Let's go over some of the details of this case. Laquan McDonald, the teenager, he did have a knife in his hand, but then there was that dash cam footage that came out like more than a year after the shooting, and it showed that he was walking away from the police officers when Van Dyke is seen to shoot him 16 times. What kind of defense will Van Dyke and his lawyers make in this case?
Well, one part of their defense that we've heard from them so already is, you know, that video that almost everyone in Chicago has seen does not give a whole picture. It's a, you know, they call it a silent film. It's only from one perspective, and what's most important to their defense is that it is not from the perspective of Officer Jason Van Dyke. And so, you know, what they say is it may look like Laquan McDonald is angling away from Officer Van Dyke from the perspective of the dash cam that's behind both of them, but that from Van Dyke's perspective, that's not what he saw, that's not what he perceived, and he believed his life was in danger.
And what about the prosecutors?
Well, you know, what we can expect about what they're going to do in court is play that video and show the fact that Laquan McDonald is, you know, 10 to 15 feet away from Officer Van Dyke. He's about parallel with him, but does look to be angling farther away. The knife is in his hand, but it's a folding knife with a 3-inch blade. They're going to say there is no danger here. And one thing I think they're going to point to is the fact that there are lots of other officers who were on the scene at the time who did not even draw their weapon. You know, Laquan McDonald had been followed for about 10 minutes by different officers, you know, without any real incident. They didn't see any need to draw their weapon. Officer Van Dyke gets to the scene, and within 30 seconds, he starts shooting and unloads his whole gun. I think that's something they're going to talk about at trial.
Yeah. Van Dyke's lawyers have asked the judge to move the trial outside of Cook County because they say the defense cannot get a fair trial in the city. Is that still an option? Is it likely to happen? And is there a sense that, in fact, it would be hard for him to get a fair trial there?
Well, I don't know if it's likely to happen. One unique thing that the judge has done here is he has held off on ruling on that request until after they do the process they're doing now, interviewing the jurors. Basically, what the judge has said is, I want to hear from the potential jurors and decide for myself if they really are, you know, tainted by all the media coverage. I will say, you know, just being at the courthouse, potential jurors are walking past. At least last week, they were walking past hundreds of people lined up with convict Van Dyke signs and pictures of Van Dyke with writing over it about how he's guilty. You know, you could see that this environment is very different from even your average murder trial.
Yeah, and you know, there was a big headline last week that Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel said he would not be running for re-election. A lot of people pointing to the timing of that announcement, that it was so close to this trial and a case that a lot of people questioned the way he handled it. How has all of this affected Rahm Emanuel politically?
Well, it affected him a lot. You know, he has not said that the timing of this is because of the trial. He said it's just because he wants to spend more time with his family and he just doesn't want to do the job for another 4 years. But, you know, the timing of the Laquan McDonald shooting fits in a really interesting place within Mayor Emanuel's legacy. It happened during his first term, but no one really knew anything about the true nature of this until almost immediately after he won re-election for a second term. The settlement with the family, a $5 million settlement, was reached just a couple days after he won re-election. A lot of people think that if this had come out before that election, he would not have won. And now, you know, he announces he's not running just on the eve of Jason Van Dyke's murder trial. It really kind of frames his second term and I think could end up defining his legacy in Chicago, because a lot of people believe that he played a part in keeping the videotape of the shooting hidden and in sort of trying to control the media messaging and make sure that the truth of what happened didn't come out.
Well, regardless of his reason, nerves are certainly raw there in Chicago over this case. That's Patrick Smith, criminal justice reporter for WBEZ at the courthouse in Chicago as jury selection gets underway in the murder trial of Chicago police officer Jason Van Dyke. Patrick, thanks very much for your time.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.